It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with a friend if you like it. Today, I have two guests with me. Cassie Garcia is running for Congress in Texas's 28th district. She is running up against Henry Cuellar, who you may be familiar with as one of the more conservative members of the Democratic coalition, in a district that butts up against San Antonio and includes a vast majority Hispanic population. She's made it a competitive race. We are also joined by Abraham Enriquez. He is the founder and president of Bienvenido, which is a nonprofit focused on Hispanic voter outreach and the like. They both talked to me about the factors that we're seeing at play when it comes to the critical issue of Hispanic voting going into November's midterm elections. You've probably seen the different reporting, the concerns being raised among a lot of Democrats that they are losing hold of Hispanic voters. You may also have seen some of the pushback that says that this is something that, you know, was a freak accident or something like that that happened in 2016 and 2020. But if you talk to smart consultants who are paying real attention to what's going on here, we really are seeing the breakup of the demography as destiny approach that said that as long as Democrats continued to weigh in favor of more government funding and the like, that they would be destined to have these types of voters as a critical part of their voter cohort going forward. Abraham Enriquez and Cassie Garcia coming up next.
Did you know that every major diaper company either financially or vocally supports abortion? If that appalls you and you're looking to support a baby brand that aligns with your pro-life, pro-family views, then Every Life is your solution. Every Life firmly believes that regardless of where someone is from, what they look like, or whether they were planned or unplanned, every baby is a miracle from God worthy of love, protection, and celebration. Every Life offers high-performing, supremely soft, premium diapers and wipes delivered right to your doorstep. Their diapers are crafted without fragrances, dyes, lotions, latex, parabens, or phthalates. And you can feel good knowing that every purchase with Every Life contributes to changing lives through their support of pro-life organizations and pregnancy resource centers. Every Life is not just changing diapers, they're changing lives. Visit everylife.com to learn more. That's everylife.com. And don't forget to use promo code Duffy10 for an exclusive 10% discount on your first order today.
Cassie and Abraham, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Absolutely. We are honored. I'm honored to be here today.
Thank you, Ben. Really appreciate the invitation.
So obviously one of the things that has received so much attention in the last couple of months, in a way that I think, you know, has been a long time coming, has been a dramatic shift in voting patterns that we've seen among Hispanic voters across the country, but really in a tangible and measurable way in recent elections and certainly in recent poll data. And I wanted to do something where we had the opportunity to kind of get the perspective both from someone who's trying to reach those voters and someone who's trying to connect with them as part of a broader outreach. And so, Cassie, I wanted to go to you first. You know, when you saw the branding that the New York Times chose to give you and your fellow far-right Latinas, what was your reaction to it?
You know, it's absolutely ridiculous to see what the New York Times would do to call us far-right Latinas because of our conservative values, because, you know, it's painting Hispanics because we go to church, you know, and, you know, we are pro-life, pro-God, pro-family, pro-country. So when they say these things, call us tacos or, you know, going to speak at a Latinx inclusion conference, you know, that's not what the Hispanics and Democrats, you know, identify with down in South Texas. And so it didn't resonate very well. And to be honest with you, people were saying, well, I guess I'm a far-right Latina too, or Latino, because I go to church. And so they don't identify with that at all.
Abraham, this is a development that's been coming for a while, as I said. What were some of the earliest indications that started to pique your interest in terms of the way that you saw Hispanics responding to questions that indicated that as a voting bloc, they were really moving away from the types of things that they had been assumed to value when it came to the left's recipe and menu of ideas and policy concepts?
Yeah, Ben, so it's really interesting because I think for a long time, the Latino vote, Latino community has been very apolitical. In 2019, right after graduating college, I wanted to be active, a volunteer with any organization or grassroots movement that was getting out the vote for conservative causes in the Latino community. And there really wasn't much out there because Latinos just didn't show up to vote. And I think a lot of that had to do with there was never any pressure for Latinos to go out and to get excited to vote. And then 2016 happened, right? And then throughout the course of President Trump's administration, we saw a record low Hispanic unemployment rate. We saw a record number of first generation Latinos graduating from four-year college universities because of the charter school initiative that the Trump administration paved out, as well as over a million Latinas entered the workforce from 2016 and pre-COVID. So I think all of that put together made the Latino community understand if you go out and you vote, you'll get policies that really safeguard the values in your community. And then you have someone like Joe Biden running around the country saying the United States needs fixing and Democrats really adopting this message of America is not the land of opportunity. It's not a great country. And you talk to any Latino, regardless of where they stand politically, they'll tell you that America is a beautiful country. It is a great country. So when the Democrat Party has adopted and progressive leftists have adopted this idea that America needs fixing and America is inherently wrong and Latinos need help and we have this victimhood mentality, it forces Latinos to no longer sit on the sideline and be active civic participants in our election process. And you saw that in 2020 when President Trump increased his Latino voter turnout by over 20%, right, or 20 points. But I also think it's really important to note some important things here, Ben. You know, Civics, which is a predominantly Democrat-leaning poll, just came out with some approval ratings from President Biden. And nationally with Hispanics, it's just about 41%. In Texas, we have 32%. Of approval ratings. In Florida, 37%. In Georgia, 21%. Arizona, 41%. In Nevada, it's 40%. And then even when you ask Hispanics how the economy is doing, 62% say it's getting worse. And when you ask Hispanics how their personal finances are doing compared to, you know, just last year, by a 4-to-1 margin, Hispanics say they're doing worse now. And that's all according to Democrat polling from Civics. So it really tells us how Latinos are awakening to the idea that economic prosperity and economic opportunity happens under conservative leadership. So if we want to be able to provide food for our families, if we want to be able to go to work, if we want to have, cheap gas, it's not enough just to be vocal about our issues, but we have to go out and get to vote. And I think that's what we're seeing with the trends in South Texas. So I'm really excited that Latinos are really coming out and saying, we're no longer sitting on the sideline. We're not letting a party take our vote for granted. And Latino vote really is up for the grabs. I'm happy to know that there's leaders like Cassie Garcia who are stepping up and saying, look, I am the opportunity, right? I am your kind of the awakening within your community. And that's why Latinos are really attracted to these candidates.
You know, Cassie, I'm curious as to your perspective on the ground in South Texas and the kind of things that you're hearing that are consistent with what Abraham described there. What are some of the issues that are brought forward to you by voters who may have been relatively disengaged prior to the past couple of years?
Yeah. So just to give you some context, in District 28, you know, South Texas and District 28 is over 80% Hispanic. And I've lived there my whole life. And when I talk to my friends, you know, and my neighbors, I meet people who tell me, hey, Cassie, we're lifelong Democrats, but something has happened. This is no longer my Theo's Democratic Party. They've become too extreme. And what I tell them is that they're absolutely right. You know, Washington Democrats used to be the people we had disagreements with over marginal tax rates. And now we see debates on fundamental issues such as, do we have a secure border or not? And what is the definition of recession? And so I think what's happened is that they went from having leaders who spoke at union halls, sounding like a party of faculty lounges. And I think there's even a deeper problem here, what we see in South Texas, when Democrats, you know, come to our community to talk to the Hispanic community, they're so out of touch. And then the issues that we are seeing in talking to voters all throughout the community and throughout the district is the economy, inflation, securing the border. And so you hear that from the district extends from the Rio Grande Valley, from Starr County to Laredo, up into San Antonio and Guadalupe County. That is on the hearts and minds of the voters. They're talking about that every single day. I meet voters every single day and tell me, Cassie, you know, your values, talking about pro-God, pro-family, pro-country, those are my values too. The Hispanics are abandoning the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has left the Hispanic community. And that's why we talk about that shift, we are going to see more Hispanics come vote Republican come this November because of the issues. The Biden administration is ignoring the people of South Texas. Our Border Patrol agents are doing everything they can to secure our southern border, but the administration is not lifting a finger. It's just absolutely insane. So talking to voters, that's what motivates me every single day, talking to the mom who's struggling to put gas in her car because the administration is celebrating a 30-cent decrease in gas. We were under the previous administration, we were energy independent. We were paying $1.87. So when we're talking to the voters, that motivates me. You talk about the win of Miraflores in June 14th, you know, flipping a blue district red over 150 years. Look at District 28. It's been Democrat control for 110 years. I've got Henry Cuellar, who's been in office since 2005. People are ready for a better path forward, and I'm ready to represent them in their values and put them first. And that's why come this November, we are going to see a red wave.
So I want to ask this first of you, Cassie, and then of you, Abraham. There were obviously a lot of assumptions made by the Republican Party and by the Democratic Party about the track that Hispanic voters were going to take and the issues that were going to be the most important to them. These are assumptions that have been built in over the past several decades. And I think that you can point to the post-2012 Republican autopsy as being kind of the apex of those assumptions, you know, express in white paper form. And everything that you really heard from the Democratic side was these Hispanic voters in America will automatically be brought into a coalition, a multicolored, multi-ethnic coalition that relies on government resources and funding, and that pushing out these different benefits to them is going to be critical to keeping their votes, but they automatically belong in our coalition. And from the right, and I realize I'm painting with a broad brush, but you actually heard pretty much the same language, you know, that once these Hispanic voters come into America, they're going to get onto Medicaid and onto welfare programs and the like, and they're going to want to stay on those and protect those, and they'll be automatically Democrat voters. And the only way that we can get around that, you know, in the words of a lot of corporate and donor minded Republicans, was Republicans just need to deal with the immigration problem, and they basically need to surrender. They need to just sort of say, you know, anytime we talk about the border, it makes us look harsh. We've got to figure out some way to go through. Obviously, that was rejected by Republicans over the past decade or so. And instead of, you know, finding that it resulted in them diminishing gains among Hispanic voters, the opposite has happened. So Cassie first, and then Abraham, why was the conventional wisdom from the left and from the right, why was it so wrong?
Yeah, so when you talk to Hispanics, we're hardworking. You know, I grew up in a very conservative household. My dad worked two jobs to make ends meet. You know, and my dad's like, we came here, I'm third Texan generation. And so my dad said, we're living the American dream. You know, so we worked really, really hard. You know what? There are government programs in place to help you. You know, Hispanics want a hand up, not a hand out. And what the Democrats have done for a long time and forever has taken the Hispanic vote for granted. You know, they want to press. They want to give government programs, you know, and like I said, these programs are in place to help you, right? To help you to succeed in life, to live the American dream, because that's what we care about. You know, we care about a strong and secure border. You talk to Hispanics, they don't want to see an open border. They want to see, you know, there's a process in place, right? We need to work on that process, right? To streamline it, and something that has not been done or been touched. And so you know, we talk about supporting legal immigration, not illegal immigration. And so when you see the amount of people that are coming into our country every single day, and the fact that the administration is doing nothing, not even talking about it. And we have a border czar, Kamala Harris, who's done nothing, absolutely nothing to talk to, you know, to provide relief. And we have Secretary Mayorkas, who's turned their back on the administration, on the Border Patrol, you know, in our law enforcement community. So Hispanics are waking up, and I talk about this all the time, but going, being on the ground, talking to voters every single day, they say, Kathy, we can't vote Democrat. There is a Democrat county judge in Webb County who said, if the administration and the Democrat Party is for supporting open borders, count me out. This is not my party. And so I think people are waking up. People are motivated. Hispanics are wanting, you know, more opportunity. We're spending more than we've ever spent. And we're talking about inflation, you know, and the president's talking about this Reduction Inflation Act. I'm sorry, that is going to hurt people in South Texas. We can't continue to increase taxes. And so people are waking up. These policies, you know, the reason why I'm running for Congress is to defend faith, family, and freedom. And I'm running to offer our community a better path forward. Washington Democrats talk a lot about their cultural values, but they don't value families. And I want to get our economy moving again. And I'll always support pro-growth policies that are going to strengthen our community. We are hardworking people in South Texas, and we just need the federal government, you know, and its reckless policies to get out of the way.
Abraham?
Yes. That was great, Cassie. You touched on a lot that I think is great to unpack on both sides. But Ben, you know, I do think that the Democrat Party, their mindset on what you said earlier about government dependency and building this coalition of Latinos that are automatically going to be attracted to the Democrat Party because of government, systems at play to support the Latino community, that hasn't changed whatsoever. And you see that, and it's confirmed with how they're so pro open border policies that are allowing generational shifts of families to come in through our open border, quite honestly, to be immediately dependent on our government. So, you know, I as a first generation Latino who is very involved in our political process, I can't wrap my mind around how is a Democrat Party bleeding through Latino votes or just completely losing the Latino community. How are they not changing their messaging? How are they still adopting things like Latinx, pronouns, which less than 2% of Latinos actually identify with? And you want to know why? It's because they don't care. Because they know that if they can continue to keep our borders open, these millions of undocumented immigrants who by now, if they go to California or states like New York, they're allowed to vote. You know, they know that if they can just get a massive wave of illegal immigrants in the name of amnesty, they will have control of the politics of the House, the Senate, the White House for years to come. That is their push. So they will continue to adopt policies like the Green New Deal, gender neutral pronouns, not care about inflation, not care about security, in the hopes that we will turn a blind eye and continue to let these massive influx of immigrants coming through our border and really just breaking amnesty laws, taking advantage of our flawed system of immigration. And the community that is mostly affected by illegal immigration is the Latino community, by far and large. You go down to districts like Cassie Garcia, Myra Flores, there's families that are scared to walk out of their home, let their kids play basketball outside of their front yard because they don't know what's going on in their neighborhoods. I also think it's really important to note that the Republican Party for years have really not done a good job of outreaching to Latinos. Let's be completely honest. President Trump said that Mexico wasn't sending their best United States, which is true. Well, let's be honest, the Republican Party wasn't sending their best to outreach to Latinos. And you look at why Monica de la Cruz, Mayra Flores, Cassie Garcia, Yesley Vega, Juan Ciscomani are doing amazing in the polls. It's because they are candidates that sound like the community, look like the community, are from the community, and understand the issues of the community. The Republican Party is finally embracing these candidates, putting resources behind them, and they're seeing that with these amazing leaders on the ballot comes the community to support and defend their candidates from their community. So I think that what we're going to see is Democrats are still going to continue for a climate change, progressive left Latinx policies in hopes that Republicans will be distracted and not get serious on the border because they know that they'll be able to win generational votes through, you know, their push through amnesty with what we're seeing. But what's changing here is that Republicans are embracing this tough on crime, pro-border security, pro-law enforcement. I think we sometimes even forget that majority of Border Patrol agents are Hispanics, right? But the key here is how Republicans have been able to embrace Latino candidates. That's huge. And Latino candidates that are actually from the community. And each one of those candidates that I just mentioned, there's something distinctly different from them because not all Latinos are the same, right? And so what's driving this shift? And I think that the answer really just varies by region. You know, you look at Cubans, Venezuelans, Colombians from South Florida. It really doesn't help that the Democrat Party has hurt themselves by making a squad of socialists or figureheads of the party. I think it was what Tom Perez that said AOC is the future of the Democrat Party. So what does that mean? That means that the Cuban vote, which had been trending Democrat for about 10 years, finally swung back to 2000 Bush era numbers because the Democrat Party adopted this idea that this socialist messaging and ideology was good. And then also in places like Texas and border counties in Arizona and California, we saw big shifts among Hispanics that were driven in large part because the Democrats don't even, you know, they don't even pretend anymore that they care about border security. And then in Puerto Rican communities, in Orlando and Philly, we see Boricuas who are very concerned about crime in their communities and critical race theory, radical gender theory and going on in their children's school. And then nationally, when you consistently see that Hispanics, many of them have worked their way out of poverty and all they want is economic opportunity and growth for their kids. They don't want to hear lectures on victimhood and oppression, Ben, that has been given to from Democrats to our community. And you look at polling, 70% of Hispanics say that America is still the best country in the world. So I think the Democrats are still going to push for open border policies. The Republicans have really an advantage here by selecting and recruiting and supporting candidates like Cassie Garcia, who are really making a difference with voter outreach.
So I'm curious about one aspect of this that I'd like to get your both of your responses to. You know, Abraham, you can feel free to go first. That you've both mentioned kind of the deployment of the term Latinx. And one of the things that struck me as being so ridiculous about the embrace of that term, which seemed to happen overnight, though we know it has this sort of unique history within these critical race theory conversations, it was such a ridiculous term on its face to describe a population that is very different based on, you know, not just where you came from, but in terms of your own local priorities, you know, where your community resides and the like. You know, my family on my father's side came from Spain. My father's Puerto Rican, but we have never really considered ourselves to be part of this because we grew up in the American South and he himself was an army brat. He grew up all over the place. And my, you know, connection to that world, you know, we still have family members who are there, but it's such that, you know, while you might be able to check a box that says that you qualify for this type of leftist definition of victimhood, it's ridiculous on its face. And it also has nothing, it says nothing about your own experience in terms of the heritage or the values or anything that you have. It doesn't even tell you whether, you know, you prefer soccer or baseball, you know, and it's one of these things that is just so out of touch. And yet it was adopted and embraced by the left so quickly. And as soon as I saw that happening, my initial just knee-jerk reaction was, people aren't going to like this. They're not going to accept it. And it's because if there is anything that is taught, that is ground into people, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, who come from the Hispanic experience, it's that victimhood has no pride to it, that it is actually something, it is the opposite of what you should seek to attain. It is not something that you should be in any way proud of, and you certainly shouldn't slap yourself with it. It is the opposite of the community values of everyone who I know who works and lives within these communities. Why did the left make such a huge mistake with this? Why do they continue to make such obvious mistakes? What is your own explanation for how Latinx kind of came to be and why they got that so wrong?
So I guess it's important to note, Ben, that this Latinx is a term that was not created by Latinos. It was not created by Latinos. Is not accepted by Latinos. It is not part of our lexicon. It was created by elitist white liberals. So if you want my honest opinion, I think Latinx was created from white liberals who understood that in a lot of places like Arizona, Texas, Florida, California, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Georgia, the Latino demographic is growing so much that if you don't get a control of the vote now, there will be no path to victory without the Latino vote. So before that, before the 2020 elections, I think white liberals really understood we've got to place some control over the Latino vote so that we can have wins across the country. So, you know, they think that let's create this term called Latinx and they're going to fall in line, right? They think that they took us for granted. They thought, okay, here's a white liberal that's going to put something in front of us. And just because they say to do it, we're going to do it. And that worked for maybe a while when it came to the conversation on immigration. But finally, I think Latinos had enough with saying, hey, we're no longer going to be a community that is controlled by people that are not even from the community, right? People that don't even look like us, understand our background. And I think that, you know, though that term might do extremely well in coastal elite cities like Los Angeles and New York City. You get down to Brownsville, Texas, Latinx is not a thing, right? From both Democrat circles and Republican circles. You know what's a thing? How are these families going to get across this budget-crushing inflation that we haven't had since 1981? How are families going to choose between their completing their grocery list or a complete gas tank, right? And so I think that we need to have a conversation within Latino voters to understand that Latinx is a term used by white liberals to control Latino voters, and it's not working, right? Mm-hmm. Only less than 2% of Latinos actually embrace this ideology. And the fact that the First Lady went to a Latinx inclusion luncheon makes me understand that they truly aren't serious about the Latino vote. And you know what's something interesting, Ben, is that when Biden first took office, this administration was boasting and they were proud of how many Latinos they were putting on senior cabinet positions and advisory roles within the White House, which, by the way, the media said nothing about the amazing Latinos that President Trump had advising him around him. But you know what? What I feel is that the First Lady going to Latinx inclusion luncheon and saying that Latinos are only good for eating tacos and working at bodegas, without really even explaining that we're more than that. We're teachers, we're lawyers, we're CEOs, we're pastors, we're everything, but you know, including bodega workers as well. It makes me understand that while this administration might have Latinos working for them, these Latinos in the White House don't have a seat at the table when it comes to decision-making. Because if they did, someone would have told the First Lady, first and foremost, don't go to a Latinx luncheon where majority of Latinos are gonna feel alienated from you. And second, do not call them taco eating bodega workers, right? So every Latino in the White House right now, including Secretary Mayorkas, has absolute no access to the Bidens. And that was proven when the First Lady went to San Antonio.
Secretary Mayorkas and Secretary Becerra in particular have been huge disappointments in their particular roles. Cassie, I wonder, has any voter naturally come up to you and expressed themselves as, or described themselves as being Latinx in your entire campaign?
Not one.
Not one person. Not surprised.
Yeah. And, you know, Abram, he hit the nail on the head on there. You know, not one single person. My dad, you know, you have these table conversations and my dad will call him, my mom will call him and say, what's Latinx? Me, that, like, I don't understand what that is. I'm like, I don't know either, you know? But again, you know, you talk about how Democrats, you know, they want to control how we speak. And, you know, we don't talk about pronouns, you know, like all Americans, you know, we're worried about rising food prices and crime in our community. So when you've got Dr. Biden coming into to San Antonio and saying we are unique as a breakfast taco, we capitalized on that. You can go to nobuenobiden.com and buy your own unique as a taco t-shirt.
I, Cassie, I'm curious, you know, the particular nature of the Texas experience. You know, you've had the state Democratic Party, you know, try to sell Wendy Davis to Hispanic voters. Now they're trying to sell Beto to Hispanic voters. You know, you've seen them sort of nominate time and again these people who seem to come from, you know, these elite white, you know, sort of positions, and basically tell people you should vote for me because I'm so left on abortion or guns or, you know, some of these other issues. it's a big part of the problem here that, you know, if the Democrats wanted to make inroads, they would be speaking more about kitchen table issues. They would care more about those issues as opposed to embracing what is essentially the same far left social cultural policies that their elites and donor class seems to favor.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? Latinos aren't buying their liberal pandering. No matter how loud they yell, they're made of words like Latinx, or it won't change the reality of their failed policies. I've got no clue what they're trying to say. Nobody does. The voters, at the end of the day, they care about the issues, putting gas in their car, putting food on their table, you know, trying to make ends meet, trying to get baby formula. How do we secure our southern border? Those are the questions that are being asked to us. Is there going to be any relief soon? What is this new package going to look like? Is it going to increase my taxes? You know, you got Kamala Harris saying that we've got more money in our pockets. We do not have more money in our pockets. These failed policies, I tell everybody, these are going to be the issues on the ballot come November. And elections have consequences. And so we, you know, the RNC has opened up Hispanic community centers. The first one opened up was in Laredo. You got one in McAllen and one in San Antonio. And Abraham touched on this too. The GOP are investing more resources in the Hispanic community so we can get out there and talk about these issues, talk about the messaging, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, we believe in the American dream. We believe in God. We believe in strong borders and opportunities for our families. So that, you know, it's these made up words, you know, they don't exist in the Spanish language, you know, and it's something that none of us identify with. And so it's just like Abram mentioned a while ago, it's being forced on us by elites and non-Hispanics who don't know or understand our culture. So the bottom line is, you know, we care about the rising cost of housing and food and gas and issues that are impacting everyday Americans. And as I'll say this over and over again, you know, we care about securing our border. You know, we want to celebrate legal immigration, not illegal immigration. So these issues, we're talking about them every single day on the campaign trail. And we are going to work tirelessly every single day. We are, you know, if just like Mara Flores became the first Mexican American to represent District 34, when we win this race in November, we will win this race. I will be the first Hispanic Latina to ever represent District 28. And when Monica De La Cruz, she will be the first in District 15. Yesley Vega in Virginia 7. So there's a lot of us Hispanics that are running races across this country. And again, we are so blessed to have the support behind us, but more importantly is being able to connect with the voters, to be able to deliver that message, and people that look like us, you know, look like them. And I've gone into homes, say, oh my God, I've never had someone like you, Hispanic, come into my home and talk to me about issues. And that's what we're doing every single day. We are going to energize the voters to get out and vote come this November. Early voting starts in October. So we're energized, we're motivated, and I'm not gonna sleep until, you know, I say we sleep when we're dead, right? We're gonna work hard every single day to reach every voter out there, Republican, Democrat, independents, you know, and talk about these issues. You know, my opponent has been there since 2005 and it's time. He's done nothing to secure our southern border. And you know what, I'll tell you this, he's always received the endorsement from the National Border Patrol Council. And this cycle, they did not endorse my opponent. They endorsed me in this race. So that tells you something right there.
I want you to admit something, though. As a far right Latina, my joke about that was, as soon as I saw them, I said, if you think they're far right, just talk to their moms, because all of them are going to be further right than they are. Is that true?
That's very true. My mom has some other choice words, but yeah.
So. No, all their moms think they're squishes.
My mom said so.
Abraham, but as we wrap up here, I'm curious just about the outreach side of what you mentioned. Obviously, there's an enormous opportunity here for Republicans to advance what has already been built in the last several years. What does it come down to when it comes to keeping these Hispanic voters within the Republican coalition, keeping them naturally as conservatives who are supporting conservative candidates versus, you know, sort of a situation where, you know, a new presumably Republican majority in Congress, you know, has, you know, doesn't match up with what they sold to them. How do they make sure that these are voters who are here to stay for them, as opposed to potentially losing them back into that field of voters who could be in play for both sides?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question, Ben. And at Bienvenido, the organization that I run, we believe in the power of showcasing conservative policy and messaging within the Latino community. It's not that Latinos aren't conservative. We're very conservative. It's that we haven't really had that welcoming bridge into the movement and into the party until now. I mean, the last time we really saw this wave of Latino turning Republicans was under President Reagan. And what it comes down to is something very simple. I think it comes down to the party and Republican groups and conservative groups to not see Latinos as a different demographic, a different group. We're Americans. I mean, a lot of us have had families that have lived in America for years and years and years, generational, you know, priority with American values. So this idea that Latinos feel like they have to somewhat assimilate to something that is not, you know, right? That's not correct, right? I think the Republican Party, in order to keep these Latino voters, is just simply understand that there is no such thing as Latino causes, Latino values that are separate from American values. Every single American issue is a Latino issue because Latinos are American. We celebrate our culture because our culture is American culture. And if Republicans embrace that message and really showcase that message and say, hey, we are providing resources, we're getting behind candidates that are from your community, and we don't want to change anything about you because you're just as American as anyone else, that's how you win the vote and keep the vote, right? More importantly, keep the vote. Also, something that's really interesting, Ben, is that as we're having conversations across the country, specifically in South Texas, where Cassie's at, for years and years, the Democrat Party has kind of sold this idea that Latinos are oppressed and we're victims to systematic racism and we need help. They're going to have a really tough time continuing that message when at the top of the ballot, you have Robert Francis O'Rourke on the Democrat ticket. And on the Republican ticket, you have names like Cassie Garcia, Monica de la Cruz, Mayra Flores, under Republican ticket, right? So I think that what we're going to start seeing is Republicans are really going to start figuring out, wait, this party that I have always felt inclined to vote for really truly is a party of white elitists. And the Republican Party has turned into the party of the people, by the people, and from the people. So I'm excited to see what the Democrat Party is going to do post midterm elections, because this whole idea that the Republican Party is racist just doesn't fly anymore when you have three amazing Latina candidates in South Texas and also all across the state of Texas are running for Republican office. And I'm also really excited, just as the Democrat Party has used the Black church, you know, predominantly to outreach and get the vote out. For the first time ever, within Bienvenido, we have a faith assembly. We have thousands of Latino pastors that for the first time are saying, I want to open up my church for voter registration drives, for my community to understand, my congregation to understand the importance of voting, not for a candidate or for a party, but for Judeo-Christian values, defending the unborn, religious liberty, security. Those are all values that are found in the Bible. And for the first time, you have Latino pastors who are coming out and saying, I want to be active in this election process. So just like the Democrat Party has used the Black church for years and years and years, I think there's this unique opportunity for the Republican Party to embrace Latino evangelical faith leaders to push the message of religious freedom and Judeo-Christian values through candidates like Cassie. So I'm excited for what's to come for the Latino community, Latino vote within Republican circles and conservative movements.
Abraham and Cassie, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Ben. Honored to be with you.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. I wanted to give a little bit of a pause sort of language for you all. If you've all been excited about the potential of a red wave that would sweep Republicans and conservatives into power in both the House and the Senate this fall, I'm not telling you that that isn't going to happen. And certainly there are a lot of prognosticators who still believe that it will. In fact, perhaps the majority of them that you hear from on our airwaves and who are, you know, analyzing this, you know, from a responsible perspective, believe that Republicans are likely to take the House of Representatives. The question is more about the Senate, where there's a lot of uncertainty that has been injected by the addition of a number of different candidates across the country who are either politically inexperienced, have inexperienced or perhaps poorly funded campaigns, or are hampered by the gubernatorial nominees in their states who may provide less of a support and more of a drag on their potential likelihood to win in some critical battlegrounds. I wanted to run through these candidates really quick because it seems to me that there's different people and different factors going on here than we've seen traditionally in a lot of different cycles. Typically, you have cycles where, you know, people like Mitch McConnell and the top-down donor class really exact a lot of power in order to determine the candidate that they like, where there's also a grassroots, you know, potentially conservative candidate who is going up against them, and that nomination battle, you know, ultimately results in a party that isn't really unified going into November. This time around, it hasn't really played out in such clear-cut ways. Most of the time, the Trump-endorsed candidate has won. Now, sometimes that's meant a lot, sometimes it hasn't. But the point is that most of the time, he's ended up with the person who he favored from the get-go. That's not something that is necessarily at odds with the Republicans who are in Washington, Mitch McConnell, or the donor class, the business community, or the like. In fact, in states like Nevada, where Adam Laxalt was the choice, you know, he was someone who unified really a lot of the conservative support, and also had support from the establishment, and also had the endorsement of former President Trump. If you look at a state like Ohio, or, you know, a couple of other contests that happened, such as in Pennsylvania, there was a split between the candidate that conservative groups like the Club for Growth favored and the ultimate winner in the case in J.D. Vance and Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania, who prevailed and who ultimately are going to be set to go into November. But there wasn't really a hard, you know, establishment investment behind one particular candidate who was in the race. There was not necessarily a feeling that there was another option there. And then in states like Georgia, where Herschel Walker is the nominee, the fact that he was endorsed from the get-go by former President Trump, and that he had a very strong gubernatorial candidate in Brian Kemp, who won despite President Trump's endorsement of his opponent, David Perdue, it created an odd scenario where he may actually be able to benefit from the fact that the establishment and the business community is so much in favor of Kemp returning to the governor's seat against the Stacey Abrams campaign. In North Carolina, you know, you saw this play out in sort of different ways, with ultimately Ted Budd taking that seat. Eric Schmidt prevailed in Missouri, much to the pleasure of DC Republicans and McConnell, and of course, also people like Rick Scott, who's the head of the NRSC, who all wanted to see someone other than Eric Greitens get the job. And Greitens had lobbied very extensively for President Trump's endorsement, ultimately didn't get it, though unless you sort of think that last minute endorsements of quote unquote Eric, which could have applied to either Schmidt or Greitens, helped him at all. And then, of course, you had Arizona, where Donald Trump was in favor of Blake Masters, the Peter Thiel-backed candidate who ultimately became the nominee there. But there wasn't a really hard sort of investment on behalf of any of the other candidates in the race from Washington sources or the business community backing either Attorney General Mark Brnovich or businessman Jim Lehman as an alternative. So what you have ended up with here is a slate of candidates who are, for the most part, the choices that former President Trump made in each case. But they all have challenges. The challenges are perhaps greatest for someone like Dr. Oz, who is facing a real uphill climb in Pennsylvania, a difficult race where he's trying to keep a Republican seat held previously, of course, by Senator Pat Toomey, against the challenge of someone who's won statewide before, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who also can rely on a lot of small dollar donations, being as he is connected to the whole Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. And Oz himself, you know, had to fight a very expensive primary campaign against a well-funded candidate in Dave McCormick, one that, you know, really spent up a lot of his resources and left him without a lot of money at the moment when it comes to the fights that they're going to have. You see similar problems for a number of these candidates whose fundraising operations will need to really kick it into high gear after competitive primaries in which they used up a lot of their resources. And on the flip side of that, you have the challenge of a Democratic base that is now more highly motivated than perhaps ever before. You saw that particularly, of course, in this Kansas vote that ultimately led to the failure of a pro-life attempt to amend the Constitution and allow the state legislature to exact limits on abortion. This ballot issue failed. It failed significantly. There are a lot of reasons for that, both the complex nature of it and the well-crafted media campaign that those on the side of abortion, pushed in the state, a campaign that relied on opposition to mandates and stressed individual rights and the like, as opposed to being sort of a typical shout your abortion approach. What I think has really happened is that while I do believe that the Dobbs decision, getting rid of Roe versus Wade, was one that does not likely inherently shift the number of voters who will come out, what it has done is it has excited the Democrat donor base and their small dollar donors to really start giving in a much more significant way. We see the fundraising uptick that happened at the end of June that has continued through July that has money pouring into Democrat coffers. And really, I think, has closed a lot of the enthusiasm gap between the right and the left, setting us up for a situation where that red wave is going to be crashing into a blue one this November, where the level of turnout that we see on both sides escalates dramatically, and where Democrats don't necessarily have the kind of downtrodden attitude that they did just a few months ago. Within the House, this is probably isn't enough to change anything. You're very likely to see a situation where, thanks to their very solid recruitment and the effort that they've already put in, Republicans take the House quite handily. They only need to win a couple seats to do it, and they'll win far more than that. But when it comes to the Senate, where things are going to be a much harder road, just given the amount of space that Republicans have to defend, given retiring incumbents and the like, this could prove to be too hard of a task for them to do in a cycle in which you have so many people who are essentially political neophytes, people who haven't run for office before, inexperienced campaigns, and now a fundraising problem that could prove to be a real difference maker for a lot of these candidates. It bears watching. It's too early to say things one way or the other. There's always a race that breaks in ways you don't expect it to going into any kind of midterm like this. But it just certainly is not something where I think the red wave can be assumed to lift up and cover up the sins of a lot of different candidates who could, you know, very well run the risk of getting exposed as not being ready for prime time. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.